It's been quite an interesting time here this last month and a half, especially as I know we're all adjusting to not just life in a socially distant context, but just at home with your spouse, with your kids, and just the 24/7 exposure that we all have to one another. I've really been struggling, I'll be frank, you know, finding myself getting so easily annoyed and frustrated with the kids, things that didn't really bother me as much before, now just really getting on my very last nerve. But it's funny, because especially with my son, Aiden, the more I get frustrated with him, the more and more I see myself in him. The more I realize that, I mean, he's just like me, and that's unfortunate for him, that in a lot of ways he's very similar to his dad. My mom has often told me that he's the spitting image of me, what I look like when I was a child. He has so many personality and temperament likenesses to me. And in many ways, that's been useful because I really get Aiden. I understand him because we're so similar. And yet, at the same time, that's also meant that I often find myself saying to him the exact things that my parents used to say to me. Isn't that terrible when you find yourself turning out to be just like your parents? Not so bad, but you know what I mean there. I mean, all the time I catch myself saying the exact things that they used to say to me, right? Because I said so, or stop playing at the table, get off the back of the couch. Son, you're proof of the doctrine of total and radical depravity, right? I mean, all those things. Right, we grow up hearing our parents give us countless unsatisfactory answers to things that seem to us to be legitimate concerns and issues, right? Our parents never seem to give us the answers that we wanted when we were kids. And what do you know? Our kids never seem to be satisfied with the answers that we give them. Of course, nothing is probably as grievous as one particular answer that our parents used to always say to us. I mean, you know how the scenario went. You would ask to do something or ask for something, maybe to go to a party or to stay out late with your friends. Your mom and dad would say no, to which you would complain, but that's just not fair. And of course, you knew what they would always say back to you. Who said life was fair? And how, you know, man, that would just infuriate you. It always felt like this cop-out to me. Like, that's not a real answer. That's not a real explanation. Right? Whenever my mom or dad would say that to me, I'd always think they must just not have an answer for me. Or they just must be out to ruin my life and they just won't admit it. And yet it turns out, though I'm not sure we realize it when we say it to our kids, but it turns out that who said life was fair might be one of the most profound biblical truths that we teach our kids. It's one of the questions that the book of Job addresses. It's one of the things that it seeks to answer, this question of, is life fair? Right? Does God operate the world according to justice? In other words, should we expect justice in this world? Are injustices, are they an indictment of God? Is the existence of evil and suffering, is that proof that God does not exist? Or is it proof that God must not be both all-powerful and all-good? He can be one or the other, but not both. You see, we may joke about the answers that we give to our kids, but don't let the jokes fool you or mislead you. We deal with an incredibly important and serious question today. Because we've been watching recently Job and his friends go round and round in these debates. They're trying to sort out the cause of Job's suffering. And in their search, we've explored questions like, well, do we have to appease God in order to earn his blessing? Is our hardship, is it proof of some sin in our life? And we've seen how the book of Job is less of an explanation of why Job suffers, and it's more an explanation or an exploration of God's policies, how he governs the world. Right? The Bible says that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, that to truly be wise, to live in a wise way, we have to trust God. What Job asks is, well, is God worth trusting? And so we're continuing to look today at this cycle of dialogues between Job and his friends, and we find that the human mind expects the world to operate in a logical way. And thus we try to force God in His ways into the paradigm of our expectations. Yet true wisdom and understanding is found not in explaining the ways of God, but by worshiping and obeying Him. And so we're going to kind of jump around in our passage today and really kind of looking at it more thematically than chronologically, looking at chapters 22, 24, and 25. We see here really the final words of Job's friends. And in these words, we find this truth that we are tempted to think that either life must be fair or that God is uncaring. Now, the tone of these dialogues is now extremely agitated. These men have realized that they've reached an insoluble impasse with one another. Zophar doesn't even speak this time. Bildad hardly has anything to say at all. And even Eliphaz is succinct, because they're just repeating the arguments that they've already made. And Job, he's having none of it. We see an unwillingness in the three friends to consider any alternative argument to Job's dilemma. No, they're convinced that they're right, that they possibly cannot be wrong. Eliphaz, he argues that God is just, and therefore because God is just, that's proof that Job must have done something wrong. He says, "Is not God high in the heavens? See the highest stars, how lofty they are." In other words, God cannot possibly be wrong. And while that's true, right? Eliphaz's issue in this book has never been that he holds wrong beliefs about God. His issue is that he simply consistently, wrongly applies the truth of God. Right? As we've seen that God is just, and He does ultimately punish wickedness. But the way that God demonstrates His justice is not always in the way that we might expect or demand. You see, Eliphaz argues that God always acts in a way that corresponds to our sense of fairness. Right? Do you get that? He believes that in his estimation, it would be unfair for a righteous person to suffer. And so, rather than reevaluate this position, to say, wait, are my presuppositions right in the first place? No, he says, Job, you're not righteous. He says, agree with God and be at peace. Thereby good will come to you. If you return to the Almighty, you will be built up. If you remove injustice far from your tents, for then you will delight in yourself in the Almighty and lift up your face to God. In other words, Job, repent, do good works, and your suffering will stop. God will bless you. Right? Eliphaz is just concluding that a person who suffers cannot possibly be innocent. Which is frankly an absurd argument, right? I mean, Job argues in chapter 24 just how absurd Eliphaz's reasoning is. Because he argues there are plenty of examples of wicked people who thrive in life and never suffer. He says, why are not times of judgment kept by the Almighty? And why do those who know Him never see His days? From out of the city the dying groan, and the soul of the wounded cries for help. Yet God charges no one with wrong. They wrong the barren childless woman, and do no good to the widow, yet God prolongs the life of the mighty by His power. They rise up when they despair of life. And for Job, it's not just that bad people seem to get away with their wickedness. No, he says there are also plenty of examples where innocent people suffer, right? The world abounds with injustice. We can list large-scale examples of this, like the Holocaust, where 6 million people at least were murdered because of, what, their ethnicity? How is that fair? We have large examples of this here in the United States in our history, and even today, slavery, segregation, lynchings, police brutality, right? Circumstances where people are victims of injustice simply because of the color of their skin. What about things like when a child gets cancer or is molested or left in the car in the parking lot and dies of heat exhaustion? Where's the justice? Where's the fairness in that? I mean, Job asks some pretty good questions here. Questions that we have all asked. Questions that we have all been asked. Where is God when terrible things happen? You see, even though we intrinsically feel like life should be fair, it does not take a whole lot of work to see that life is anything but fair. And so it seems then that in order for us to maintain some belief in God, we have to conclude that God is uncaring. He just must be unsympathetic to the plights of humanity. Right? And we find ourselves tempted to question the goodness of God in order to acknowledge His sovereignty and power. Bildad, he argues this. He says, God is so high and so sovereign that He's indifferent to the affairs of man. Says dominion and fear are with God. He makes peace in His high heaven. How then can man be in the right before God? How can he who is born of a woman be pure? How much less man who is a maggot and the son of man who is a worm? One commentator summarizes Bildad's argument like this. He says, in light of the awesome transcendence and justice of God, humans are insignificant and incapable of meeting His standard. In other words, that's what Bildad is saying. There's no such thing as a truly innocent person. God is so great, and we all fall so short of His standard, that we have no place to accuse Him. Often as Christians, we can be guilty of making this argument. We'll do things like quote Isaiah 45, woe to him who strives with him who formed him, a pot among earthen pots. Does the clay say to him who forms it, what are you making? Or your work has no handles? We'll quote Romans 9. Who are you, O man, to talk back to God? Shall what is formed say to him who formed it, why have you made me like this? Does not the potter have the right to make from the same lump of clay one vessel for special occasions and another for common use? My point is that just like Job's friends, we take theological, biblical truths and then we universally apply them to every situation the same way, without regard for either the scriptural context of that passage or for the spiritual context of the person to whom we're speaking. In other words, what we say often as Christians may sound biblical, it may sound right, but it fails to provide any comfort to those who are suffering. And it may not actually be correct. Now, Bildad doesn't go there, though. No, instead what he concludes is that because God is so great and because man is not, God is just simply unconcerned or unmoved with our circumstances. Humanity is a maggot, is a worm. How can we expect anything from God? And so for Bildad, he's saying, yes, God is all-powerful, God is great, but what does He really care for our everyday lives? Really not an uncommon point of view that Bildad argues here. It's the basic premise of agnosticism, the basic premise of deism. It's the central tenet of many Eastern religions like Buddhism. Humans are insignificant. And God might be out there somewhere, but He certainly isn't here, and He does not care about our day-to-day affairs. You see, the reality of suffering and the problem of evil, it leaves us in a place where we feel like, okay, I've got to choose between God being all-powerful or God being all-good, but He seemingly cannot be both. What's interesting to me, though, about the book of Job is that the characters here seem to go in an opposite direction than where we usually go. Right? We've been seeing this throughout this book. Starting back in chapter 2, there's never been a question here of God's sovereignty. Nobody has ever seemed to question God's power. The question has always been about His goodness, the way He does things. I would argue that in modern evangelicalism, we do the opposite. We're so concerned to preserve the goodness of God that we're often willing to compromise on His sovereignty. could give examples of this, but that's a conversation for another day. My point is that the book of Job is very clear that God is in control. The sovereignty of God is implicitly assumed, not just here, but throughout the whole Bible. Now, what does it mean when we say that God is sovereign? Well, a simple definition of sovereignty might be to say that God is king, supreme ruler, and lawgiver of the entire universe. That's what it means that God is sovereign. That God has a perfect purpose for all of creation to restore the created order so that the relational disruption between God and creation that's created by our sin can finally be resolved. God will establish His reign throughout the entire universe. That's what it means that God is sovereign. And so according to that perfect plan, He is directing His world to that intended end. Or as another scholar puts it, the purposes of God in the gospel are focused on God's longing to put the world to rights. Now we'll touch on more of God's sovereignty in relation to the existence of evil at the very end of this book, when God finally shows up and speaks to Job. But just for now, here in these dialogues, it's important that we see that these questions being asked by Job and his friends, this is really the issue that the book as a whole is addressing, right? This book has not been about why do people suffer. This book is saying, does the fact that God both allows and sometimes sends hardship, does that mean that maybe God is not good? Does it mean that God cannot be trusted? You see, in Eliphaz, we have a man who has seemingly just stuck his head in the sand. He says, God is good, God is in control, and so if you suffer, then you must be bad. In Bildad, we have something similar, but a little more nuanced, right? God is in control, God is good on His own standards, but we suffer because we're insignificant to Him. In other words, either life is fair, or God doesn't care about you and me. And Job can't accept either of these conclusions, and frankly, neither can we. For as we see in Job's wider responses, he's holding out hope for final vindication. But even that hope he has for the future fails to answer the cause of his present suffering and his questions about God. See, we see next that God will bring final vindication, but we still struggle now to discern His ways. You see, we find implicitly in Job's words this belief that God will ultimately carry out justice, but for some reason, God is failing to do so right now. Job argues, God prolongs the life of the mighty by His power. They rise up when they despair of life. He gives them security and they are supported and His eyes are upon their ways. They are exalted a little while, but then are gone. They are brought low and gathered up like all others. They are cut off like the heads of grain. If it is not so, who will prove me a liar and show that there is nothing in what I say? In other words, the wicked thrive in this life, proving Eliphaz to be wrong. But God is aware of such wickedness, and He will one day punish such wickedness, proving Bildad wrong. The issue for Job, then, is, okay, why does God work in the way that He does at present? Though He is ultimately just, He doesn't seem to be governing the world right now with justice. And so Job is left to conclude, okay, there's something wrong with God. Maybe God has made a mistake. Oh, that I knew where I might find Him, that I might come even to His seat. I would lay my case before Him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would know what He would answer me and understand what He would say to me. Would He contend with me in the greatness of His power? No, He would pay attention to me. Job, he can't fathom his circumstances. And thus, because he thinks that the world is unjust, he thinks that God must be unjust. And if God is unjust, well, then God can be manipulated. Right? I mean, what we're seeing throughout these chapters is that in Job's mind, God doesn't discriminate between the righteous and the wicked. God doesn't do what's always right. As God lives, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty who has made my soul bitter. As one commentator observes from Job's response here, if we expect justice in every circumstance we face in life, we are going to be disappointed. And in our frustration, that disappointment can take God as its focus. Someone has to be blamed. And so Job now commits his second error. He's trying to show God where God has been wrong so that God can correct the way that he governs the world. Job says, God has cast me into the mire, and I become like dust and ashes. I cry to you for help, and you do not answer me. I stand, and you only look at me. You have turned cruel to me with the might of your hand. You persecute me. He concludes, let me be weighed in a just balance, and let God know my integrity. Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my adversary. See, Job thinks that God can be outmaneuvered. God can be shown to be wrong. And Job thinks that he's the man to do it. See, tragically, at this point, Job has come to see God as apathetic, preoccupied, and I would say even inept. And unfortunately, I don't think Job's alone in this perspective. I believe that in Job's weak theological conclusions, we can see ourselves here. Right? How often are we guilty of thinking that we know better than God? How often do we find ourselves thinking we could do a better job than Him? As one commentator writes, with Job, we must learn that it is not our place to hold God accountable. In fact, such a theological idea creates an oxymoron that intrinsically construes God as less than God. See, the mystery to understanding the world, to living rightly within the world, it doesn't rest in human logic. It doesn't rest in human reason. Right? In a world that features order, non-order, disorder, well, justice cannot reign. But we see that that is by God's design, and the very existence of things is a reflection of God's wisdom. Simply put, we need divine wisdom in order to understand this world. And friends, that divine wisdom cannot be found in any other place than in the fear of the Lord. You see, finally, in our passage today, that we may only see the world rightly when we are in full submission to God. See, chapter 28 is an interlude in all of these dialogues. It's something written by the narrator of the story. In other words, this is not Job speaking in chapter 28, but rather the person who writes his story. And the reason we have this interjection is to call our attention to all the nonsense being spoken by these characters. Right? It's an interjection to show us that, hey, if we're going to figure this out, we need God's wisdom. You see, in chapter 28, the narrator brings us back to the fundamental issue that has somehow been obscured in all of these speeches. The narrator is starting to point us to the fact that Yahweh is going to show up here in a couple chapters, and He is going to speak. In other words, what we see in chapter 28 is that only God understands the way to wisdom. Whereas every human character has been claiming to have all the answers and to have all the understanding, in fact, only God does. As one scholar writes, wisdom is a mystery that only God, the possessor of all wisdom, can disclose. Now, chapter 28 is easily divided into three sections, right? In verses 1 through 12, we see that human searching cannot find wisdom. Man puts an end to darkness and searches out to the farthest limit, the ore and gloom and deep darkness. But where shall wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? Right? The point here is that although God has very carefully hidden all the precious jewels and metals of the world, humanity has found them. But not so with wisdom. Wisdom remains elusive despite all the developments and ingenuity of the human race. Next, in verses 13 through 22, we see that wealth can't find it. Wealth cannot bring wisdom. And so instead, in verses 23 through 28, we see that God alone understands the place and way of wisdom. Right? Just note the verbs throughout these verses and see the link between God and wisdom. God understands the way to it, and He knows its place. For He looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When He gave to the wind its weight and apportioned the waters by measure, when He made a decree for the rain and a way for the lightning of the thunder, then He saw it and declared it. He established it and searched it out. And He said to man, "Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to turn away from evil is understanding." Right? Wisdom is found not by knowing everything about the world, because that lies beyond the range of humans. Wisdom is found through reverence to God and obedience to Him. Wisdom is a God-given means for us to understand and live in this world. Of course, understanding doesn't mean having every detailed answer. It means trusting in God's good purposes for His world. That's the promise of verse 28. As one commentator writes, "The truly wise man is the one whose life is centered on God and not self, and is regulated by God. Man, in right relationship to God, worshiping Him, serving Him, and obeying Him, that is wisdom and understanding." And so this is where we have to stop in our questioning of God, stop in our doubts, in our accusations of Him. This is where we must begin in order to find wisdom and understanding. Because the answer to the problem of evil, it doesn't reside within us. The answer to why isn't worked out by human reasoning. And neither does that answer have to satisfy our every demand. No, the only way to rightly understand the world is in reverent submission to our Creator. Simply knowing that wisdom is found in the fear of the Lord, that's not enough though. I love what one scholar observes. Job affirms that God knows the way to wisdom and grants it to those who fear Him. Yet the fact remains that Job has not yet been granted the wisdom and understanding he needs to resolve his dilemma. Why does a righteous man suffer in God's good and ordered world? In other words, for Job, it's like, okay, God has the answers. But how can I, in my hardships, find satisfaction in that? I think we all say that, right? Okay, God has the answers. God is all-knowing. God has a purpose. But in my hardships, in my suffering, how can I find satisfaction and hope in that? Right? In the tragedies of human existence, how can I find peace and comfort and confidence? How can I trust knowing God has a perfect plan for restoring the world to Himself? How do we do this? That's what I'm saying at this point. And it's only through the person and work of Jesus Christ. Old Testament scholar Elder Smick, he observes this here. Is the very heart of the problem of evil. The book of Job lays the theological foundation for an answer that Job's faith anticipated, but which Job did not fully know. God, the sovereign and therefore responsible Creator, would Himself, in the person of His eternal Son, solve this human dilemma by bearing the penalty of the sins of mankind, thus showing Himself to be both just and the justifier of all who trust in Him. In other words, there's no explanation that mortal creatures can give to explain why God allows evil and suffering. But the promise of the book of Job And the promise of the gospel is that nothing is beyond the purview of God's power and His providence. You see, Paul promises that in Jesus, God is working all things for the good of those who love Him and are called by Him. Now, in our emotions, in our rationality, you say, well, yeah, but God doesn't always feel that way. But the gospel shows us how God has responded to our sin, how He has responded to evil, how He has responded to rebellion, but how He has also responded to our hurt, to our suffering. How He has done all of this with a sovereign love that was set in motion before time began. How it is a holy love that spares no expense in what it would pay to rescue those who through our own inclination have sold ourselves into the bondage of suffering. You see, it is Jesus who endured the greatest suffering, who though being truly righteous and truly holy, how He bore the wrath of a holy God against sin in our place. It is Jesus, friends, who came to stand in that infinite void between God and man. And not to plead our innocence to God, but to plead His own innocence on our behalf. It is Jesus who became man, that a world in rebellion against God might be made new and restored to a Creator. It is Jesus who conquered death, that we who trust in Him for everything may have peace even when we don't have the answers. See, the book of Job has been showing us that the world is broken. That it's broken because we rebelled against God. Right? The book of Job shows us that we as human beings, that we are broken. And we are broken because of, instead of humbly worshiping God, what we do is we accuse Him of wrongdoing anytime the world doesn't look like the way we think it should. But the book of Job also shows us our need for God to overcome that brokenness. Our need for Him to speak, to reach out, to make us new. Is life fair? Does the world operate according to justice? No, it does not. But the God of heaven and earth has given His Son so that this broken, unjust world might be made right. He, the very justice of God, has become our justice before God. As Paul wrote, "For there is no distinction, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and are justified by His grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation by His blood to be received by faith. This was to show God's righteousness, because in His divine forbearance He has passed over former sins. It was to show His righteousness at the present time, so that He may be the just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus." Jesus is the perfect justice of God. And He is the one who makes us just. And He is the one who will one day make all things right and just as well.